You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are all rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm right.
I'm sorry, but I cannot believe the call. You've got Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. I can't believe the call.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown. Welcome back to Hot Takedown for the second ever episode. This is 538's podcast about the week's narratives in sports news. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor here at 538. To my left is the one and only Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad. Good to be here.
And across the table, Kate Fagan, an ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Guys, can you believe they let us back on the air?
No.
I can't believe people are back listening to us the second time. So, busy show today, as ever. We're going to talk about the women's basketball tournament. We're going to talk about what's going on in Oklahoma City with Kevin Durant and the Boston Celtics. And then we're going to talk... First, we're going to talk about men's college basketball. How much college basketball did you guys watch this weekend, guys?
It was pretty wall-to-wall, I'll admit, over the weekend. I feel like I watched nothing else and paid attention to nothing else.
Yep, exactly. Do you all have the March Madness app?
Sure do.
Yes. So
it
you
was
can,
push
you
alerting know, me all weekend.
Okay, you can pretend to be social with people while looking at your phone.
I was at a party on Saturday night in which no one was looking at their phone for scores, and I felt as though like I was in another universe and where I was the only one who knew this was happening. So to recap what happened in college basketball this weekend, we had a crazy first day of the tournament in which people were literally falling out of their chairs on the court. It was so nuts. There were only 273 perfect brackets left at the end of the first day in the ESPN Bracket Challenge. It's 11.6 million brackets total. So it went way down to 0.01% or whatever it is almost immediately. And yet, once the first round was over, it wasn't actually that upset crazy. Once that second day came around, our colleague Nate Silver calculated the most upsetty first rounds ever, and this was didn't even rank in the top 20. What did you guys feel as you were watching? Did it feel crazy all the way through, or did it?
The second day felt pretty boring
to
me. The first day, amazing. Second day, no game I felt was as intriguing as that first day.
And I think the magnitude of some of the upsets, like the 14s beating the 3s in ever more increasingly improbable fashion, made the first day more exciting. And it happened in the span of like an hour, I think those two games ended. So it gave the sense of, hey, this is going to be a really upset-laden tournament. And then you get to the second day, and it's kind of business as usual.
Right. And one of those upsets on the first day was UCLA being SMU on a questionable, let's say, goaltending call. And they're now in the Sweet 16. And let's go to our first hot take of the show, Doug Gottlieb, before the tournament even started.
UCLA safely in is a joke to me. There's not a reasonable person in America that believes, based upon numbers, UCLA belongs in the field of 68. They are 2-8, 2-8 against the field.
All right, guys.
They beat Utah once at home. That's what they're hanging on to.
2-8 against the field, and yet now 2-0 in the field. So now that we look back, was Gottlieb right, or are two games enough to convince us that he was wrong?
I think it depends on how you look at it, right? Like UCLA, if you just looked at something like the Ken Pomeroy ratings before the tournament, they clearly deserved to be in the tournament. They were better than any of the other teams that were mentioned as bubble teams. And you can argue about how Pomeroy's system is set up where, you know, they got credit for hammering teams that they were clearly better than, and they had a questionable record against teams that were better than them. But at the end of the day, this is one of the more predictive, if not the most predictive, systems of power rating out there, and they were the best of the bubble teams. So in that sense, it's kind of ridiculous for him to say the numbers don't support them being in the tournament. Then if you turn it around, two wins, one against a 14 seed, I believe, and then also the first game where they won on one of the more mind-boggling calls I've seen in a long time, that doesn't prove that they deserve to be there. If anything, it's ammunition that they didn't deserve to be there. So I think it all depends on whether you look at it looking at the numbers during the regular season or if you look at it as the tournament itself.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in an unfortunate position of almost agreeing with Doug Gottlieb a little bit because there's no evidence, as you mentioned, at this point right now to say that they've justified being in the tournament. And I think we're in a position where we're not going to ever find out whether they should have been, because if they lose to Gonzaga, they still made the Sweet 16.
Right.
And Gonzaga is obviously a very strong team, but you could also argue that that could be a win that UCLA moves into the Elite Eight, and they still haven't like run into a powerhouse team this year.
For some reason, when I keep thinking about them being Sweet 16, I think about going to their stadium at some point 5 years from now and seeing that Sweet 16 banner hanging in the air, and no one's going to care whether they beat a 14 seed and a 6 seed on a last minute questionable referee call.
Except Doug Gottlieb,
right? He'll still be harboring this injustice all the way through. But like, these things in sports tend to create their own legends, and then we sort of forget what was behind them, and then they just become historical accomplishment. We don't really go back and think about it.
Right. And it's worth noting that even if they lose the next game, they've already won two tournament games, and the average 11 seed only wins 0.6 tournament games on average. So by any standard, it's been a very successful tournament run for them already. And like you said, especially if you don't think about the manner in which they won those games.
The one thing I'll say is, why weren't they in the first four? You know, like, they really should have been one of those teams that was playing a play-in game. We don't call them that anymore. We call it the first four.
Right.
But they really have somehow miraculously like gotten on a road that has not had a ton of hurdles, considering they were the last or one of the final one or two teams into this tournament.
And now they have a 24% chance of making the Elite Eight, according to 538's model, and a 6% chance of making the Final Four. So as you said, Neil, it's probably the end of the road pretty soon here, but maybe that doesn't matter, because they've pushed back on their critics and they've shown they belong.
Yeah, and maybe just going back to what you were saying, Kate, about the fact that they were a team that might have deserved to play in that first four, they're almost like the archetypal team that loses in double digits during the regular season, but they have that underlying talent, they're a big program, and then you get them in a situation where they're an 11 seed, they're probably much stronger than the normal 11 seed would be, and those are the types of teams that rattle off those upsets, and kind of, they're not even real upsets necessarily according to some of the power ratings.
Right, because the talent that team has and possesses has a max level that's much higher than a traditional 11 seed or 12 seed. Like a couple years ago, Colorado, and this was on the women's side, they had a great season, ranked in the top 20. They ended up with a 5 seed, expecting, I think, to get like a 12 sort of mid-major. And then they ended up getting Kansas. And, you know, of course, like 20 and 11, but the talent of a Kansas team. And you could see right away that was going to be a really tough matchup for them. And they did. They were upset in the first round. And I think when you are in that position where you're like a top 20 team and you're in that 5 sort of seed hole, the worst feeling is when you look and you see a UCLA. Because sure, the numbers might say that they're not as good, but they have UCLA talent on that team. And on any given day, they could perform like a top 5 team in the country.
And that might speak to the flaws in the way that the tournament committees seed things, in the sense that a lot of times they can't decide whether they're giving credit for a team being talented versus maybe a team that had good accomplishments during the season. And then having to weigh in the quality of schedules also makes it really difficult. I mean, their job, I do not envy them, of having to rank the teams and set up the seedings.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's no way if UCLA is in the tournament, they're not an 11 seed.
Right.
But what do they do? I mean, they really should be. At that point, they're kind of like a top 30-level team once you take away all of the conference bids, automatic bids. But then they're sitting in that 11th hole just waiting to pounce, especially when a road like what has opened up before them opens up.
So one of the other surprises of the weekend was Michigan State, who beat Virginia in the round of 32, and it was sort of, here we go again. I mean, we've seen Tom Izzo do this a few times, and here is our next hot take from Tom Izzo himself on Tiki and Tierney on CBS Radio.
I guess what I'm saying is, I never once thought that this was anything close to being a vintage Spartan team, but here we are again. What changed, or what button did you hit? How are you guys doing this now?
Well, you know, we haven't been. I mean, for the most part, we've been pretty good defensively. We've been a decent rebounding team. You know, you're right. We're not a vintage, not as talented of a team.
So here we are, guys. Michigan State's just won two games, just like UCLA. We're trying to make judgments on a small sample, but is this a vintage Michigan State team that we're watching?
Well, it depends on what that actually even means. If you look at them compared to their other Final Four teams, this team is kind of average, maybe a hair below average if you look at the SRS ratings, which is a schedule-adjusted points per game margin.
Which we should say is basically saying how much is the margin victory expected to be, and then we're going to adjust it based on how hard the schedule is that you've played in the games leading up to it.
Right. And so this year's Michigan State team had an SRS of 17.5. And just to give you some context, the 2010 Final Four team had an SRS of 15.3. And the 2009 Final Four team had an SRS of 17.7. So it's not totally out of the realm of possibility that this is exactly like one of those Michigan State Final Four teams that we've seen in recent years.
Yeah, it looks very much like a vintage Michigan State team just from watching them play. And, of course, the hallmarks of a Tom Izzo team always being defense and rebounding. And this team out-rebounding opponents like, you know, 37 to 31. That's pretty Michigan State to me. As well as having no guy averaging over 15. Like, that's just the way they always have played. So I think the one thing that is different about them, and even Tom Izzo said this in the media a few days ago, just they're terrible at free throw shooting, which is not usually a hallmark of a Michigan State team and could come back to haunt them because they're at like 63% free throw. So there are certain like skewed factors about this team. It doesn't seem as Michigan State to me, but at the end of the day, you have a Tom Izzo team that takes some lumps during the regular season, figures out how to play good defense, even if there is no like two or three individual star defensive players. As a team, they play great defense. And then come tournament time, they end up winning based on those factors. So that's vintage.
And how much can we say Tom Izzo has to do with that? I mean, it seems like we're, again, having this conversation every year around Michigan State, and it's unclear how much the coach has to do with a team mm-hmm. gelling at the end of the season. Or is it the fact that these are kids and they're learning how to play together every year starting over?
Well, with Izzo, it's part of a very repeated pattern, so I think it's pretty safe to say that he's doing something right. We are going to have a story up on the site today where we look at coaches whose win totals exceed the expectations based on where they were seeded, which is a little like what we were talking about earlier with UCLA. And since 1985, which is when the tournament expanded to 64 teams, no coach has exceeded their expectations as much as Tom Izzo. He has 15 more tournament wins than he should have had based on where Michigan State was seeded. And the next best coach is Rick Pitino with 11.5 more. So he is many, many standard deviations above average in this particular stat about overperforming expectations in the tournament. And I think that's not an accident.
And what about Coach K?
And Coach K is actually a lot lower than you would think. He ranks 21st in that span. So, you know, even though Tom Izzo only has one title and Coach K has four over the same span of years, you also see with Coach K, first of all, his teams are always very highly rated going in. A lot is expected of them. And as we've seen in recent years particularly, they don't always live up to those expectations. Whereas the Tom Izzo team, like you were saying earlier, is more of a team that is seated in the middle of, you know, the top half of the region, and then somehow kind of finds a way to win. And many times we've seen Michigan State sneak into the Final Four with improbable string of wins.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'm just thinking through this. It's kind of like, well, what is the common factor with mm-hmm. Izzo teams? Obviously, the quick hot take there would be, well, defense and rebounding wins championships. Therefore, if you are specializing in throughout the course of a season, drilling those types of things more than other programs, and who's to say whether he is or not, I mean, because all programs are drilling that stuff, well, then do you perform better in the tournament? Or is there something larger at play here?
Right. So the Krzyzewski winning four versus Izzo's one is interesting to me, because are we supposed to be judging teams based on their regular season performance, in which case Krzyzewski, I think, probably is going to look better, or they're overperforming in the tournament. Because actually, the flip side of this, if you're an Izzo hater, would be, well, Izzo's not getting his team in shape before the tournament mm-hmm. Well enough, and so we should judge him poorly as a coach because of that.
Right, because his regular season record probably pales in comparison to Coach K's regular season record. So is he coaching in a different way, that he's maybe playing different guys during the year to try and figure out defensive rotations? Like, what's he doing that is allowing a perfect formula, not perfect, but a formula to come to the surface, come NCAA tournament time?
Tom Izzo, you are welcome to come on this show and tell us what you're doing. I mean, like, I think this is the kind of thing where you actually do need to talk to the coach or to a beat reporter or something and see what's up.
Yeah, and the only other interesting thing is, right, like teams like Duke and Kentucky, Louisville to some extent, Arizona, those are teams that are in the hunt for these one-and-done players who definitely skew the win-loss records, whether, you know, they're there 1 year and team is really strong. Next year, maybe they're rebuilding or looking to replenish with, like, top-level talent. Michigan State is not one of those programs where they're getting the type of one-and-dones that a Duke gets and a Kentucky gets. So does Izzo – that's another question that I would love to ask him, too, is, all right, so if you're getting that second-tier level player, but you're getting that player to be there for 3-4 years, a high talent level, and you're getting 3 to 4 years, that should produce tournament wins just as much as if you're getting a top five prospect.
And that brings us back into the question of what the right way or what the best way of college basketballing is these days, especially in the one-and-done era, because Calipari has shown that actually one-and-dones can work fine as long as you bring the best. And maybe Izzo is not as great at recruiting as he should be, and that's why his teams aren't performing well in the regular season. And it's only after 4 months of lecturing from him that he can figure out how to get these people to come together.
Yeah, or maybe he's like not that you wouldn't be in the market for the best players, but maybe he likes getting that, you know, those prospects who are right on the cusp, like the 10 to 30, you know, ranked across the country. Maybe he likes getting those guys.
Yeah, and maybe that's the sweet spot in a world in which you're competing with John Calipari, who's able to field a team of 15 McDonald's All-Americans, it feels like, every year, is that you look for the undervalued asset that, you know, you're not going to be able to compete with Kentucky for the top prospects in the country. So you do go for that player who's like in that area where they're still good players, but they're also not as highly sought after by some of the more marquee programs.
And that's the Moneyball approach to Billy Beane, Michael Lewis made famous through Billy Beane, which is that Billy Beane had to compete with the Yankees when he was the general manager, while general manager of the Oakland Athletics. And so he went after these marginal talents, perhaps, that he didn't have to sign, not marginal, but a younger talent especially, that he didn't have to sign to a huge free agent deal because he couldn't compete at that level. So the question is, how do you maximize benefit within the level that you can compete at? Maybe Izzo can't get people to move to East Lansing, where it's almost always snowing in the middle of December, and you have to wait, and students have to wait outside to come see somebody play in the 20-degree weather.
Yeah, I mean, how senior-laden, or I guess how experienced is this Michigan State team?
Yeah, according to Ken Pomeroy, again, we come back to him, he has the best college basketball stat site out there. This Michigan State team is the third most experienced remaining team in the tournament. And, of course, Kentucky is at the other end of that spectrum as the least experienced. So there might be something to this where you see, like, Travis Trice, he's a senior. This is sort of the mold that you think of when you think of a Michigan State team. And also going to the Moneyball approach, maybe this is what we're seeing from some of these other programs in this era of one-and-dones, where like a Wisconsin team has like a very specific type of player and they slow down the pace and they do all of these like, you know, half-court offensive sets. And then you see like Michigan State has its own brand. It may be trying to find the right players that fit your particular system is the key instead of just going after the talent, which I think was what people tended to do when they first adopted the one-and-done rule or the ban in the NBA on having guys go from preps to pros.
And another one of the edges in the Moneyball scheme that we're throwing forth here is that you convince someone like Frank Kaminsky to stay an extra year, because then you get an extra year of talent, if you will, unpaid, as we talked about last week, to help you go forward. And now Wisconsin at least appears to be as good, if not better, than it was last year, at least according to its regular season.
And the irony of discussing Moneyball with these NCAA athletes.
So the other two surprises of the tournament thus far have been Wichita State and NC State. NC State beating Villanova in their 1-8 matchup in the round of 32. And then Wichita State in a cross Kansas grudge match that hadn't happened since 95, I think, or something like
93,
that.
93, yeah.
Because Bill Self refuses to schedule the Shockers on the Kansas on the Kansas schedule. My favorite thing I read about that was that I think the Times had called Self and Greg Marshall, the Wichita State coaches, not friends but acquaintances, which was really code for they don't like each other at all. And so I bring up NC State and Wichita State to talk about conferences. And so Kansas was beaten by Wichita State, is a member of the Big 12, and NC State is a member of the ACC. And this tournament, those two conferences, which are widely considered to be probably the two power conferences this year. Is that fair to say that the Big Ten had an off year, and so it was ACC and Big 12?
Mm-hmm.
That sound right to you guys? And so the ACC is 11-1 in this tournament, and the Big 12 is 5-5. The only two teams from the Big 12 remaining are Oklahoma and West Virginia, and the ACC has Duke, Notre Dame, Louisville, North Carolina, and NC State. Vastly different. So all year I feel like we hear about conferences and whether conference tournaments matter, and we talked about this in the women's game when UConn had been blowing out people in the American Athletic Conference by 30, 40 points a game. And so we went to the tournament thinking the Big 12 was one of the better conferences, and now they're 5-5. Do we have to readjust our understanding of the conference as a whole? Does it matter? Is it just something people talk about when they talk about college basketball?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I always care about when it comes to conferences, a lot of times it's not necessarily what the data will show and what that program, what that conference's record is in the NCAA tournament. It really is the narrative about the conference, because when it comes to like the selection committee time, how strong a conference is, at least in somebody's mind, is the difference between letting in the number six team in that conference.
You mean the narrative as it affects the selection committee?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when in women's college basketball specifically, but this applies, the Big 12 was always considered, like, attendance-wise and strength throughout the conference as the strongest conference in the country. Of course, then you would have the Big East and ACC, and they would have very top-heavy programs, but across the board. And when it came to the selection, if you finished sixth in the Big 12 and it had this narrative of being a very strong conference, you were getting into the tournament. So they're very important for teams to, like, put forth these narratives that you'll hear coaches say this all the time. We're in the strongest conference in the country. That's really important to them in case they end up 17-13 and fifth in that conference. They certainly want that narrative. But when it comes to the actual, like, results, that always seems to me to be a year by year where it I don't know, and maybe you have data, but I don't know that there is any sort of correlation between from year to year how these conferences perform.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there would be correlation among the tiers of conference. You're not going to expect the Southwestern Athletic Conference
right.
to some one season be better than the Big Ten. But at the same time, yeah, I do think it's cyclical around the conferences, and I don't think that there's a lot of predictive value to how good a conference is during the regular season and how well they show for themselves in the tournament. And we're seeing this year. For instance, like if you look at Ken Pomeroy's ratings, the Big 12 was by far the best team during the season itself. And they have had a very disappointing tournament so far. And if you look at just 2 years before that, the Big 12 was only the sixth best conference in America, according to Ken Pomeroy, and the Big 10 was the best. So it is cyclical, and I do think it also, it kind of can become overblown unless you're trying to make that sell, like you were saying, mm-hmm. about we have this record and it's justified by the fact that we're in this conference. And a lot of that speaks to some of the same things that we saw with UCLA. It's not even conference-based necessarily. It's we had this record against the top 100 or the top 200 in the RPI. Like, there are a lot of these kind of arbitrary groupings of teams that if you have a good record in it, you really trumpet your great record in this very arbitrary grouping. And if you don't have a good record, then you try to find whatever alternate right. arbitrary grouping.
You're like,
grouping.
Oh, the RPA means nothing.
Exactly. Right.
This is a good example of stats being used to whatever end that yes. they need to be used to. And so one last set of games I want to talk about is what I have here on my note sheet called Death of Cinderella, which is Georgia State and UAB were so
sad
thrilling.
Disney movie.
Yeah, exactly. Our corporate parents, Disney, sent some ideas for them. So Georgia State and UAB had a thrilling first day, and then they were gone, and then Dayton seemed to be the last gasp of a real Cinderella, and then they seemed to just be gasping. I think when I was watching the game, one of the announcers said they looked tired because Dayton had played a play-in game. And so this was their third game that they were playing instead of second, as everyone else had played. And I wondered, Neil, is it the case that play-in teams tend to struggle later in the tournament when we look at whether or not we should expect them to flame out when they do?
Well, since 2001, which was the first year that we had these play-in games, the team that won their play-in game has actually won more tournament games than you'd expect based on their seed. But that kind of comes with a caveat because those wins, those 10 wins that the play-in winners have had are concentrated among only five teams. And four of them went to the 2011 VCU team that went to the Final Four. Mm-hmm. And that team wildly exceeded its expectations, needless to say. So if you take them away, then the play-in teams do underperform relative to their seedings in the tournament.
But do we think that's how it should be? That if you play a play-in game, you're probably one of the last teams at that level that got into the tournament, and so you should have to have a disadvantage when they go?
Well, that kind of goes to what you were saying before, Kate, about do we want to send some of these teams that are weaker and perhaps mid-majors to the play-in game and make them play that extra game, or do we want to make that a place to almost punish the big conference teams that have the talent but they underachieve during the season? Do you send the 13-loss UCLA team to the play-in and make them play in? It seems like that's a little bit fairer just from a subjective standpoint, yeah. But I could be convinced otherwise.
I mean, I would rather have those teams from power conferences that are the last in to play in the first four rather than a team that has earned an automatic bid through its conference. That makes more sense to me. But I can't, having played in NCAA tournaments and knowing like what that time is like, I can't imagine that playing that one extra game is really going to lead to like your Achilles heel downfall fatigue that's going to, you know, make you like run out of gas, right?
So in this case, it would be you play Tuesday or Wednesday, and you play 2 days later, and you play 2 days after that. So that's three games in mm-hmm. 5 days.
And that's very much like what a conference schedule is like, you know, where you're playing like a Wednesday and then a Friday, or a Wednesday and then a Saturday, and then you throw in a non-conference game if you're trying to fit one
So here,
in.
Yeah, maybe we don't trust that because it's actually a pretty small sample size, and common sense suggests that these people are hugely talented athletes at the peak of their physical ability, and they can play, they can run up and down the court three times 5 days.
Yeah, the only thing I wonder on that is just the factor of preparation time, and if you're playing on Thursday, you have 4 days to prepare once you know the seedings, whereas if you're just coming out, you can do some preparation, but at the same time, you're having to focus on the team that you're going to play on Tuesday and then turn around a couple days later and focus on another team. That might put a team at a disadvantage.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, and then there's the part where you just over-prepare and watch too much film as when your coach is like, stay in here from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. and watch this film.
You have to go to school? What?
What's that? That is no, NCAA.
So let's look forward real quick to wrap up the men's tournament segment. This upcoming Thursday and Friday and Saturday and Sunday, Michigan State is the team in their region that actually has the highest chance of making the Final Four. To go back to our Izzo conversation earlier, according to the 538 model, yada yada, they have a 33% chance of getting all the way to the Final Four, and it's basically a coin flip to get past Oklahoma. And once they do, then they're really favored because of the weak top part of that bracket, if I remember correctly.
Right. That just shows the absence of Villanova as right. The number one seed really plays havoc on the rest of the bracket in a good way.
Right. And so Wichita State is even odds to make it to the Elite Eight, and then a potential rematch with Kentucky, where they met in one of the better games that was played in last year's tournament. And Kentucky itself is still at 41% odds to win the tournament. They actually went down after they struggled a little bit against Hampton, which is to say, by struggle, I mean they lost by they won by 20 instead of 30, yeah. And the model had expected 30, and so they got docked a few points, but now they're back up to 41. Especially
they just
with
can't cover out. The spread.
I know. I actually saw a piece about how they were only 500 against the spread this year,
right?
And people in Vegas were sort of bemoaning how they couldn't take advantage of this excellent team because Vegas is setting the line so high that no one can really know what to do. Okay, so let's transition to the women's tournament, which we talked about a bit last week. We especially talked about UConn and Princeton. And what we saw was that Princeton won its first match with President Obama in attendance, being the first team since Harvard, a 16 seed, beat Stanford, a 1 seed, first team from the Ivy League to win in the tournament, if I'm right about that. And then lost to
Maryland.
To Maryland, thank you. Space for a second. Maryland on Monday night. Mm-hmm. And so, Kate, while you were watching, what were you thinking about while you saw that Princeton team go down at 31-1 now on the season?
I was a little disappointed, and not in the way they played, because I thought they played Maryland as an 8 seed tougher than, obviously, Princeton's the 8 seed, Maryland's the 1. But they played Maryland tougher than most 8 seeds in the women's tournament. I mean, again, I just think they should have been a 4 or 5 seed, which I think would now have them in the Sweet 16, which would give us a fantastic storyline for the women's tournament. Obviously, everybody knows the UConn storyline, and you were the women's tournament is desperate for those other storylines. So I thought Princeton played really well, their game plan against Green Bay, and then also against Maryland, until Maryland just caught fire from three. But again, like, I don't like it that we put them in an almost unwinnable situation as an 8 seed going onto a 1 seed's home floor and eliminate one of the key storylines.
And when you say
lines.
We put them, you mean the selection committee,
I mean,
right?
Yeah, apparently we was just women happening there. There's like a gender thing that happened.
And so I guess what this brings up the question of narratives in the women's tournament in general. We've struggled to find them. We were looking for a hot take for
this
segment.
We looked and looked and
looked. There were only embers left over from the piddlings, a few that we found last week. And so, you know, what is it about the women's tournament that seems so difficult to break through now that Brittany Griner's out of the league, especially, mm-hmm. to the mass audience?
Yeah, it for me, this is such a story about, like, stakes and storylines. And as I was talking to you guys earlier, like, you look at the men's basketball tournament, everybody wants to talk about how the basketball's not good, college men's basketball's dying, and yet March Madness proves otherwise. And,
highest ratings ever.
Yeah. And specifically because at the end of the day, most people don't really care about, like, upticks in quality of play if they know the stakes. And the stakes in March Madness are absurd, one and done. We're not giving these guys a 7-game series to truly decide a winner. We are upping, the stakes on the matter. And then, of course, the storylines. We know all of those because of this news cycle about men's college basketball and the storylines that it seems like the NCAA committee does a very nice job of creating for us. So I get a little bit frustrated when people say, well, people don't watch women's sports or women's basketball because the game's not as good, or people don't want to watch female athletes. No, we have proven time and time again that if people understand the stakes and the storylines in women's sports, they will tune in. Like the 2011 World Cup final in women's soccer was at the time the most tweeted about event in the history of Twitter, more even than Osama bin Laden's assassination. So people knew the stakes and the storylines. They tuned in. Last year at Sochi, the women's hockey final between Canada and U.S., gangbusters TV viewership. People understood the stakes, Olympics, and the storylines. Canada versus U.S. hockey. We all get that. So I could keep going.
And I think those also speak to the idea of competitive balance, right? It's no secret that women's college basketball has a pretty big competitive balance problem. And we talked about it last week about how UConn is so dominant. And then it just was so frustrating to speak of the Princeton seeding that the committee would take a team that could have made some noise and created a compelling storyline later in the tournament and perhaps, you know, let things build. Instead, they instantly match them up in, like you said, an unwinnable situation very early in the tournament, and you've taken out one of these teams that could provide one of those compelling storylines and provide a measure of competitive balance that I think the sport desperately needs.
To your point, Neil, our colleague Ben Morris of 538 looked at how seeds perform in the women's tournament versus the men's tournament. And as we expected, there isn't as much parity. The top seeds usually win out. But also, the top seeds in the women's tournament play to expectation better than the men's top seeds do. Mm-hmm. And so what we know about the women's tournament going in is that the seeds play as you seed them. And so that's all the more important then to then line it up correctly so that you don't have an 8 playing a 1 and that 8 seed is actually a 3 seed or whatever it might be. Because then that 3 seed would probably play at their level and probably meet that 1 seed in meet the 1 or 2 seed, whatever it be, in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, down the road. And women's basketball is constantly in this tinkering mode. Val Ackerman wrote, quote unquote, the white paper.
Val Ackerman being the founding president of the WNBA.
Yeah, and she's now the commissioner of the Big East for men's basketball and women's basketball. And there's this constant tinkering that's going on in women's NCAA tournament specifically. Like this year, the tournament went back to the top 16 seeds hosting. They hadn't done that since...
Unless you're Louisville, in which case the men, having a men's tournament at your stadium means that you can't
you
play
go to South
games.
Florida.
Yeah, exactly.
Reward. But we had and I keep saying we just because I played women's college basketball, but that hadn't happened since 2002 because the NCAA selection committee didn't want to see that unfair competitive advantage. And now they're moving the Final Four from Sunday, Tuesday to Friday, Sunday because they want more people in the arena. There are all these issues with style of play that we've seen in men's college basketball, as well as like TV viewership in arena attendance. But just the simple fix at this point, because we can't change the way the media covers women's sports, is if the selection committee, if they're going to care about competitive balance when it comes to the top 16 seeds, they're already obviously processing storylines and competitive balance. Do that for the way you're seeding this tournament. Women's basketball needs every advantage it can get at this point. So this selection committee, the next year when they're seeding it, like, pay attention to the storylines. Create some storylines.
So I'll push back a bit about the idea that media, we can't change the way media covers women's basketball, because, I mean, we work for ESPN,
that's
guys,
right.
And ESPN holds the rights to air this tournament in the first place. It's in ESPN's economic interest to build the storyline so that mm-hmm. people watch and that people want to know what's happening. And so there is something that needs to happen on the media side as well if this is about narratives. The selection committee is much more of an untouchable body than ESPN corporate heads are. So, but Neil, you had something to say about that.
Oh, just about there was an interesting article at Grantland where they talked about with regard to men's basketball and the way that the game is going through this crisis, as we talked about last week, that the NCAA might have a little bit of reluctance to address that, because then they would have to acknowledge that they are producing a product that mm-hmm. is for entertainment, and it's not about teaching values to impressionable college students. It's about trying to make money. And I think that could also apply to the way that the women's game is played and the way that they seed things. Is if you have a Princeton later and you're trying to set up a situation where they'll face potentially, what if they faced UConn? You know, that would be a competitive and very compelling game in the Final Four or something like that, and instead you have them flame out early. I think if you start thinking about things and you know how to rig it so that you have the better matchups for television later, you're also going to have to start saying, we're doing this for profit and we're trying to create a product, but we're not going to pay anyone involved.
Yeah, like last year I was working on a story about Anuka Brown, who runs the NCAA Women's Basketball Committee down in Indianapolis, and talk to like a dozen people around women's basketball about some of the shifts and changes that women's basketball is trying to make. And the line they kept coming back to was, are we a product or are we a cause? Because for years, because of Title IX, women's basketball and NCAA in general being a quote-unquote nonprofit organization, like, women's basketball was, in essence, a cause. It was not a product. It was about getting federal funding and creating another educational opportunity for these young athletes in the same way you would develop any other branch of your college or institution. But now women's college basketball and a lot of the coaches are like, we're at a crossroads. We can't keep saying we're a cause. We have to be a product. We have to change the pace of play, and this isn't women's, same thing men face. We have to focus on our tournament and figure out how we can lose less than $8 million, which is what it lost in 2013, because the biggest issue for women's basketball is, all right, it was the inaugural women's sport that the NCAA lifted up. But there are other sports now that traffic well, that move the needle on TV. Softball is great on TV in terms of its viewership, surprisingly. Women's soccer. So, like, if they're going to pour money into a sport, it's always been women's basketball. But pretty soon, some of these institutions are going to be like, hey, women's basketball maybe isn't making as much money. Let's throw that money into soccer or softball and lift that sport up instead. So, yes, of course, it always comes back to, how are they going to define it, as a product or as a cause? And the people inside the game are like, we better start looking at ourselves as a product or we are going to be pushed out.
And it brings up the question of whether Title IX, which was the catalyst, as you said, for all of this, is maybe handcuffing women's basketball at this point. We were talking before the show started about the travel budgets that these teams have to do, and they fly charter jets because the men fly charter jets. And mm-hmm. maybe it's the case where that the women's basketball does need to be a bit more bootstrappy in order to lower the overhead on the whole enterprise and make it feel maybe a little more personal, as opposed to just something that's happening as a companion to the men's game, perhaps.
Yeah, and the WNBA is now in its 17th season, in large part because it has never been gluttonous in how it operates. You know, these teams are taking like layover flights. They're going to bust when they have to bust. They're not going to pay more than 107K max salaries, because that's going to cause the league to fold in the same way previous leagues have folded, in the same way women's soccer leagues have folded. Because
the women's basketball is protected from folding because
right.
of Title IX.
But yeah, so a lot of times in talking to these people within women's college basketball, being like, the NCAA women's basketball loses the most amount of money of any NCAA championship at $8 million. They don't want that designation, and they shouldn't have it considering the amount of money ESPN pays to broadcast the tournament and other factors. But at the end of the day, as they say, they have golden handcuffs. Title IX gives them resources, but Title IX also shackles them to what the men get. And the NCAA men's tournament can certainly afford to charter all over the country, charter an entire Delta jet to fly from California to New York. Now the women have to pay that cost, and it ends up as like an anchor to what that championship costs, and they can't untether themselves because there are so many loyalists and there are so many women and men who will say, well, you can't just selectively decide when you want to impose Title IX on college sports.
And the question for me is, where does the key come from to unlatch the handcuffs? Does it come from the NCAA? Does it come from a tweak in the way that we apportion money to the different sports on the men's and women's side? Does it come from the teams themselves?
It comes from starting to pay college athletes and having these be minor league teams, right? And then that blows the whole system up, and that's another podcast. We'll talk about that.
We'll get there, I'm sure. Okay, that'll do it for our tournament coverage. And before we move on, a word from our sponsor. All of 538's March Madness coverage and this week's Hot Takedown is brought to you by Acura. Designed to excite within the first 100 yards, the Acura ILX is quick off the line with a 201-horsepower, 2.4-liter iVTEC engine. With an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission, the 2016 ILX delivers rapid and smooth shifts while instantly reacting to your every move. The redesigned ILX comes standard with Jewel-Eye LED headlights and taillights and aggressive styling, and you can stay connected as you drive with Siri Eyes Free. You can respond hands-free to texts, emails, and set reminders or check the weather. You could probably even call up this podcast and listen to it on the road. Witness the quickness for yourself. Go to Acura.com/ILX or head to your nearest Acura dealership for a test drive. The 2016 Acura ILX. Catch it if you can. All right, on to the next hot take, this time in the NBA, and it's about the emerging narrative that the Thunder may actually trade the injured Kevin Durant rather than risk losing him to free agency next year. Take a listen to this from ESPN's Sports Nation show.
He's got to do everything he can. Plus, if you give him away right away, that's telling me you don't believe in your product, you don't believe in your team. And you can go into all the analytics and the gut feel, but I'm not letting my prize beauty. I'm not letting my wife, my trophy wife, leave.
My trophy
that
wife.
Is a trophy.
If there's any way to get under the skin of this show, it's to juxtapose analytics with sexism. That really
That's
is
right.
the way to get into it.
I could just see Michelle Beadle's like head exploding.
So what they were saying, though, is that perhaps it's time to trade Kevin Durant if you don't believe in what's happening in Oklahoma City. Do we have any sense of whether that makes like even this is one of the best players in the league. It blows my mind that we're talking about this just because he missed half the season with a foot injury.
Yeah, we talked about last week with NFL free agency and about the fact that in a hard capped salary cap league that sometimes you can have like a really good player, but you're paying him more than he's worth. And it actually makes sense to cut him or trade him. And we've seen a lot of that, a lot involving the Eagles even this offseason in the NFL. But in the NBA, because they have the soft cap and they've got the maximum salary rule especially, you're never actually going to pay a player like Kevin Durant what he's worth. He's always a surplus player to you. So I don't think it makes any sense under almost any circumstances, unless you think that Durant will never play another NBA game or be at drastically reduced efficiency when he actually comes back, that you would willingly give up a player like that, especially since they had to have such strokes of luck to fall into the players that they ended up having. Ibaka, he's hurt, Durant, Westbrook, that, you know, this whole thing is kind of tenuous and they have to preserve it as long as possible, I would think.
Yeah, and the key point for me here is when will they know what Durant wants to do when his contract is up?
Right.
Because lots of people will say that he's going to go to the Washington Wizards, go back to his hometown. And I guess my question is, what's your communication like with your best player? Well, your best player, Russell Westbrook, might have something to say about that. You're one of your franchise guys. Like, what's your communication like? You need to know before the middle of next season, when all of a sudden you're completely handcuffed, if word is that he's going to be leaving to go somewhere else, whether it's the Wizards or some other place, and then all of a sudden your trade value for him is much less than it might be otherwise if you've got a free market. Nobody knows what he's going to do. So that's the question for me, is they certainly can't just let him play out this contract and then just be a free agent and go sign another deal.
This goes into the part of the narrative around Durant, which is that he signed with Oklahoma City. He re-upped during the summer of the decision when LeBron went to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Durant just announced it on a tweet or something, that there was no big...
No fanfare.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, but I want to go back to this idea that the Thunder would, quote, give him away. Because that seems to be a total straw man argument to me. Because there would be something in return, and this gets at what you were saying, Kate, that if you know he's going to leave,
mm-hmm.
and Neil, I'm curious your thoughts on this. If you know he's going to leave... the devil's advocate it, then don't you trade him? Like, even if it's just for a year, like, you take a year hit, you get whatever it is, two first rounders and a good three-pointer and defense wingman or something, and you say thanks, Kevin, for your service, and that's that.
Well, do you really know ever if one of these guys is going to leave is another good question, and maybe it does go back to that communication between the front office and the player. But as we've seen in a lot of cases, like, Miami was very convinced, I think, that they were going to be able to bring LeBron back until, like, the 11th hour. And then before that, we saw that Cleveland was convinced that they were going to get LeBron before the summer of the decision. So, you know, a lot of these, they change their minds, you know, deep into free agency. So I don't think you could ever fully rule out the idea of Durant going back. Now, the other consideration might be this salary cap explosion that's going to be due a couple seasons from now, and the fact that a lot of teams are going to suddenly have cap space, and they can throw money at Durant that you wouldn't normally see in an ordinary NBA offseason. But I think the way that the free agent game has always been played is you are convinced that you're going to be able to bring a guy back unless... you know, something very strange happens and he just outright tells you that he's leaving.
Yeah, because if you lose a guy like Kevin Durant, as you can attest to, like, the odds of you ever drafting a guy that good again, the odds of you being able to get him in free agency, develop a guy, that does not happen.
Especially in Oklahoma City.
Right. And there's not a ton of guys that want to go there from free agency. So Sam Presti, though, correct me if I'm wrong, he will figure out a way to do... what he needs to do here.
But one extra wrinkle here, though, is that Durant is hurt, that he's out indefinitely, and he's missed already 45 games in the season with a break of his fifth metatarsal, I think, is the official medical term for it. And we, at 538, have a freelancer we work with a lot, this guy by the name of Jeff Stotts, who keeps injury data on NBA players. And he's an athletic trainer himself. And people who have had Durant's injury... the median missed games of all of those people, which are 31 people in the data set, is 38 games, and Durant's already exceeded that. And so the question is, like, oh, you know, is this ever going to get better for him? And if you can sell high on our hurt guy who's not going to play in his final contract year anyway, does that change it now that we know he's hurt and maybe and with an injury that's hard to heal?
I mean, maybe it does, but I keep going back to Oklahoma City in particular. They traded James Harden. It wasn't exactly the same circumstances. He was healthy, but they didn't want to, you know, deal with the financial implications that were looming with his potential free agency, and so they traded him away. I find it hard to believe that they wouldn't take that back right now, especially the way that he's playing.
So the Thunder are in the eighth playoff spot, 2.5 games ahead of the ninth. Their counterpart on the eastern side are the Boston Celtics, who are only a half game up over the Charlotte Hornets, I believe, as of this recording. And so we were talking last week in the off time between segments about what the Celtics are supposed to do. Do you want to make the playoffs in that eighth seed to battle harden your young crew, or do you want to try and get a lottery pick and miss the playoffs on purpose? And they certainly have the power to do that. Not that Adam Silver would like hearing me say it.
Yeah, this was interesting because it started, I was on Around the Horn like 10 days ago, and the question was whether the Celtics should want to make the playoffs or whether they should not tank, but whether they should miss the playoffs and take one more shot at draft lottery, you know, luck. And I just felt like I had no data behind it, but I just felt like this whole narrative that, like, tanking is the best thing to do, and that if you're sitting in that middle ground, you got to just, like, bottom out, and there's no opportunity to build from the middle. And then, of course, the Atlanta Hawks, having been the eighth seed the previous year, fifth seed the year before that, are completely dispelling that myth. So my question to you, Neil, was last week, was, like, was that a silly thing to say that Boston should be trying to make the playoffs? And are they kind of mirroring Atlanta? And why do we still have this narrative in NBA that you have to completely tank out to get better?
Yeah, so the research that I've done on it shows that teams that kind of start from around 500, which the Celtics have kind of inexplicably become one of those teams in the past few months, that those teams tend to be successful faster and with more likelihood than a team that does bottom out and sell off all their assets. Now, the sample of teams that have truly done this in the most cynical Philadelphia 76ers style possible way is non-existent. So you could say, well, no team has truly tried to tank before in a very concerted way. But still, I mean, this is an age-old debate that I remember on True Hoop, the ESPN blog. They would always have this like rail against tanking, and there would always be people that say, oh, Tim Duncan, you know, the Spurs tanked that 1 year. Well, no, they didn't. David Robinson got hurt, and they weren't even supposed to, given their slot, win the lottery and get Duncan. It should have gone to the Celtics. But, you know, the lottery luck is the point of the whole thing. Even if you have the worst record in the league, you still only have 25% chance of getting the first pick. And then I think something that's forgotten a lot in this is even if you have the first pick, there's no guarantee that you're going to actually pick the right guy with it. And as we've seen with a lot of the research on like behavioral economics as it relates to the NFL, that people wildly overestimate their ability to pick the right player when given the right to choose. They, if you look at the amount of trades that are given in the RG3 trade, for instance, with Washington a few years ago, was a great example where they traded away a whole draft for a guy very convinced that he was going to be the savior of their franchise. And a few years later, where are we now? And that happens more often than you would think if you're sitting there and holding onto that first pick and thinking, oh, you know, this is the answer to all our problems.
I feel like in full disclosure, we should say that you're currently wearing an Atlanta Hawks long sleeve shirt, Neil, because you used to work for them. So I think we should just get that out there, that you support perhaps the way that the Hawks developed their team, maybe because they were once some part of your life.
Possibly.
But okay. But like the Hawks developing that way, I'm assuming they put some thought into it, right? I mean, they had to have been sitting, remember when I covered the 76ers, they were sitting right there in the same middle of the road spot with Josh Smith and Joe Johnson, and it was kind of like, well, they're never going to be the team, so what do they do? I mean, the way they've developed, as much as it looks almost organically, like how much thought was put into that?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the biggest thing that they wanted to do was get cap flexibility by dumping someone like Josh Smith, and kind of they almost inadvertently along the way to get that flexibility, they built this roster that, you know, Paul Millsap was very undervalued. And it also bears mentioning that a lot of the guys were hurt last year. Horford missed a lot of time. And that caused as much of anything of them not playing up to their potential. So I think we had the sense that they could be a good team. I don't think anyone foresaw them being this good as they've been this year. But that, you know, if everyone was healthy and things broke right, they could be a better team than they showed last year.
One last point on that, which is that when you are developing your team the way the Hawks are, I feel like there's still a question of whether Hawks are legit. You know, when they get to the playoffs this year, are they just going to flame out? And part of this is because when you slowly, incrementally build up and then be really good as the Hawks are this year, it's our media narratives don't quite know what to do with that, because we're used to a digital switch. You're either on or you're off. You're either excellent or you're tanking. And this middle ground is a strange space.
And also the narrative that we repeat ad nauseum is like, you have to have a star to win in the NBA. And so it's such an easy place to go to look at Atlanta and be like, well, number one, Atlanta's number one. Therefore, I cannot fathom how they could win because I've never seen it before in terms of this specific Hawks team. And then also just easily fall back on the most lazy thing ever, which is, well, they don't have a star. And there's certainly something to the fact that like star players in the NBA are very important. But maybe this is a new model.
There is data to disprove that narrative.
Okay.
But we'll get there when the NBA playoffs come around in a few weeks. Now let's bring in our colleague Jody Avergan to give us her significant digit. Soon, Allison McCann will be the one who's
so
giving
soon.
It, but she's still on vacation. She decided to go to Morocco rather than come to our second taping. That seems crazy to me.
It's ridiculous.
Jody, what do you got for us today?
Hey, everyone. So my significant digit for the week is 6. And 6 is the number of times that New Zealand has lost in the Cricket World Cup semifinals until this week, when the Black Caps finally broke through and beat South Africa and are advancing to the finals. So I'm not going to pretend I know a ton about cricket, but I did do a little research moving it, you know, thinking about this segment, and sort of found myself really intrigued by the Cricket World Cup. One just little tidbit that I loved, there were sort of two heroes to this game. Some people are calling it a huge collapse by South Africa. Others are calling it a really great stand by New Zealand. But one of the heroes of the game, this guy Grant Elliott, I heard an interview with him like right after the match. And someone ran down and said, you know, how did you do it? How'd you pull it off? And he just goes, I have no idea, which was like so refreshing. You know, like he didn't thank God and he didn't say like, oh, my teammates. He was just like, I actually don't know how I pulled that off and became the hero of this game. But, you know, one of the things that it got me thinking about was a sport like cricket, which by a lot of measures is the second most popular sport in the world. It's certainly the most popular sport in the most populous countries. How does it break through to, you know, an American television audience? ESPN is going big on cricket right now. They're airing a fair amount of it, but it's on at midnight. You know, it's a little hard to find. But one thing that I did learn is that these matches, this Cricket World Cup, is what's known as a 2020 format, which is a much shorter that notion of cricket matches taking place over like weeks or mm-hmm. days and weeks is not the case. These take like 3 hours. The game is very much about kind of like getting hits and scoring runs. I don't know if either of those terms were correct, but it's about offensive production. And you know, it's clear that cricket is at this moment where it is thinking very concertedly about trying to find an audience and trying to sort of create a product. And I'm curious to see if you think cricket will break through.
That brings it back to what you're saying about women's basketball. And what's the nice thing about cricket, which happens with any World Cup, is that the narratives are pre-baked, right? You have the former imperialist countries of England who are all trying to take England down. England is awful at cricket. At this new style
That's
of cricket.
A narrative that works for like a editor at a
and the listeners of this podcast, Jody.
Yes.
Yeah. But also you know you have Pakistan and India who are competing over despite all sorts of tensions historically with their respective populations and governments. And so for me, you know, Cricket World Cup is the only time that I really tune into cricket because it's the time that really I can best understand the narratives.
I'll come at it from a writer's perspective, and you're always looking for places where you can tell transformative stories that maybe haven't been told to an audience before. And it's very hard to do that in like the NFL and the NBA. Now, if you can find one, you hit gangbusters traffic, but it's very hard to tell stories that haven't been told. And you'll see writers now going to, and 10 years ago it was world soccer, and you know, all of a sudden being able to tell these stories. And we saw it even in the lead up to Brazil, having some of our best long form writers go and tell these stories. And cricket to me seems like the perfect place to start doing that. So in other countries they understand it, and I'm thinking now, well, the starting place is to get our media members to understand it and to buy in and to tell these really interesting stories. But the key, the thing that cricket has going for it is it's ripe for the telling, especially domestically. Like as a writer, I would think, oh my God, I want to go tell a cricket story because that's a story nobody's going to have ever heard before.
Right. And that New Zealand tidbit about how many times did they lose in a row?
Six.
So they're actually
well, it
like
wasn't
even
in a row. This is their sixth semifinal. It was also South Africa has like never made it to the final. Right. So no matter which team had gone through, that would have been a narrative. But certainly,
yeah, it's like the 2004 Philadelphia Eagles right. or something, or the Buffalo Bills if they had managed right. to pull it off. Those are fundamentally compelling stories that I think we identify with even as Americans if we don't understand the sport. But I think something has to draw us in the first place. And like you said, the 2020 rule, which I believe was pretty controversial when they first started mm-hmm. playing in that style, it was done almost like specifically to make it a televisable sport.
Very calculating. Yeah.
Yeah.
And moments like last night are the moments that do bring us in, Neil, to your point. I mean, a colleague of ours compared the final hit in the match as the equivalent of a home run in the bottom of the ninth with one out, because there were only, I think, six balls left to be bowled in that game, and then the game was over. Mm-hmm. And right. so New Zealand came very close to just not pulling it off.
And at some point, we'll stop comparing these sports to other sports in order to be able to understand them, and that'll show that they have actually arrived. But, you know, I agree with you guys that, you know, the narratives need to be there, the gameplay needs to be there. I also am just really hung up on this notion of just like the actual mechanics of watching needs to be a little easier. And I mean, yes, soccer has taken off because it's an incredibly popular sport and it's got compelling narratives. But part of the reason I think the EPL has gotten a foothold in this country is because it's on on Saturday and Sunday mornings when you wake up and there aren't other things competing for your eyeballs. And then it's presented well, and then it's compelling. But I think that that simple fact, I happen to be take far too seriously a sport that's trying to break through Ultimate Frisbee. But, you know, one of the things that's happening in our sport is that they are actually shifting the season very concertedly into the heart of the summer when they know there aren't other sports out there. And ESPN, which has started to show some of these games, they're saying, okay, well, ESPN's not going to choose us over the NFL or college football, but in the middle of the summer, in the dead of the summer, they might actually show this sport. So I think that that kind of logistics of when people are just ready to watch sports plays a huge role.
Yeah.
All right, that'll do it for the second episode of Hot Takedown. Thanks again for tuning in. We are still looking for nominations for the Hot Takedown Hall of Fame, and so send those to us and any other feedback you have to contact@538.com. 538's all spelled out. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find that theme song and the rest of this podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, Downcast. We're at iTunes.com/538. Please leave a review and a rating when you come. And Neil, thanks again for coming in for a second time in a row.
Thanks, Chad.
And Kate, you too.
Thank you.
Talk to you guys next week.